Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Fionnuala Austin, author of Bronte's Mistress, to be published August 4th by Atria. Fionnuala was born in England, but moved to Northern Ireland when she was just five. She spent her childhood telling stories to her long-suffering younger sister, as I did with my brothers, and reading all the books she could get her hands on. Look, I have an independent bookstore, so I can certainly sympathize with that. But the real words are, what else is there to do but read? So, the bookshop. Fionnuala will be appearing at Wellington, virtually, of course, along with Natalie Jenner, author of the Jane Austen Society, in a knockdown drag-out comparing the Brontes with Jane Austen. And it's funny that Fionnuala's last name is Austen. That will be on August 13th. The Zoom invitation will be everywhere, from our website to Facebook to Instagram to Twitter to email, as well as on the author's sites, the whole social melange that we find ourselves in. Fionnuala also hosts the popular blog, The Sigrid Victorianist. Bronte's Mistress is a fictional account of the possibly, probably, liaison between Lydia Robinson and Branwell Bronte. And Mrs. Robinson is the Mrs. Robinson from the Simon and Garfunkel song. That's where they got the name. Anyway, the book takes us to a world that has many familiarities with ours, with regard to affairs, wealth or the lack of it, death, familial disputes, backstabbing, grief and love, or what passes as love. It brings to life characters with whom we are conversant, but whose lives are shrouded a bit for us, although all the current book releases give us lots of new information and perspectives, as will our talk on August 13th. Branwell was a dissolute, an alcoholic, a short-statured man with ambition and talent, but not too much of it. He was either handsome or not, and along with his paramour Lydia, they forged a relationship that had its positives, and I'm afraid many negatives. Lydia is our narrator, and is she reliable or not? So maybe we'll find out. So welcome, Fionnuala, and thanks so much for joining us today.
I'm really excited to be here, and really looking forward to that event with Natalie Jenna on the 13th as well. I get to play both sides of the game by being an Austin by name, but a Bronte by choice.
And maybe hosted by one of our experts on both authors, in which case I'll be on the side without my video asking the really mean questions, and you won't know it's me.
Oh, I think I'll have an inkling, but looking forward to that too.
Okay. So let's start. I always like to start, well, the cover is great, and it's great because it only shows a part of Lydia. It doesn't show the part that would give you a better idea of what she's like, but it's enough to show you this Lydia because of her hair and the darkness.
Yeah, and that was very deliberate. There's a lot of historical novels right now where you just see women's backs and don't see any of their face, and I always think that looks like wish fulfillment. Like whoever is reading it can think themselves into that woman and her story. With this, I wanted something very different, where we still only get part of Lydia. She's shrouded in mystery, but she very much has a face, has a personality. You see that side eye that she's giving us. And this is certainly not a story about wish fulfillment. It's about a woman who's stuck in a very difficult place.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that. But before that, let's talk a little bit about the found manuscript. That means maybe you didn't write the book at all.
Yeah, so the way Bronte's Mistress starts is by a newspaper article that's a purported found manuscript. Thorpe Green Hall was the home where Lydia Robinson lived with her husband and her five and then four children. It's where Anne Bronte was governess. And from 1843, it's where Branwell Bronte joined the family to be the son of the household's tutor. But it no longer survives. Right now on that estate, there's instead a school called Queen Ethelburga's Collegiate. I visited it while on my research trip. And while I was there, the very kind janitorial staff did let me in to some of their storerooms, just in case there was anything interesting there from a historical perspective. there was plenty of interest, but it was all linked to the school from the 1910s, 1920s onwards. Definitely no forgotten Bronte manuscripts in there. But my newspaper article imagines that there was one, and that was a manuscript by none other than Lydia Robinson herself.
Is the school the original or a remnant of the hall, or was the hall knocked down?
The hall apparently caught on fire at the end of the 19th century. That's what's repeated everywhere. But I came across a really interesting article published in 2007 and penned by now late local historian Helia Hibbs, which actually suggests that the fire might not have happened at all and that this is an apocryphal story. And it's possible that the family that inherited the hall, the Thompsons, who are mentioned in my novel, actually chose to knock it down and replace it with the house that became known as Thorpe Underwood. What's interesting is that another smaller house on the grounds, the Monk's House or Monk's Lodge, where Branwell Bronte slept, became the model for this bigger house. So that's really interesting to look at it. You can see that they really took inspiration from the Tudor design of the smaller property where Branwell would have lived.
Well, sorry you've mentioned his name. Why don't you, you know, you have all the Bronte sisters, and two of whom died 10 and 11 years old. The remainder, after all this incredible work, died when they were around 30 or less. So why did you happen to choose, because, you know, you've done so much work in your life about this, why did you choose him as a subject of your, as a subject, not the protagonist, but as the subject of this book?
Yeah, I think that's a really important distinction, because Branwell is a really important part of the story. But the reason that the book is called Bronte's Mistress is it really does center Lydia Robinson and her story. So when I wrote the title, I didn't want to make it Lydia and Branwell. He definitely doesn't get even billing here. And of course, while mistress has a sexual connotation and there's innuendo, mistress here also means the female equivalent of master. She's very much the one in control. She's his employer. She's older. She's 43 to his 25 when the novel starts. And that was really deliberate. So I've always been most interested in Charlotte. And while Charlotte only appears on stage, as it were, in one scene in the novel, I really do see Bronte's mistress as my response to her work. And I really saw Lydia Robinson as the other answer to Charlotte. Lydia becomes very obsessed with Charlotte through the course of the novel. Branwell keeps telling her what a clever woman she is and that she eschews a lot of the social conventions that Lydia is enslaved to and follows without question for much of her life. And personally, as much as I love the works of Charlotte Bronte, grew up reading them, wrote a paper on her during my master's, I've always been a little bit frustrated at the lack of empathy that Charlotte Bronte can display for other women in different situations from her own. Especially there's a hostility towards any women who are more conventionally attractive that I think we see in her response to some of the silly female characters in Villette or to Blanche Ingram, for example, in Jane Eyre. So if Charlotte Bronte's heroines tend to be poor, plain, young and virginal, I wanted to have a heroine or a protagonist who was beautiful, older, wealthy, and sexually experienced. She's had five children, but is still very much trapped by the social conventions of her time. So Branwell, I think, has a lot of dramatic potential as a character, but it was really more putting those two women in opposition, a woman who makes Lydia's choices versus the woman that makes Charlotte's. And of course, tying in that there's another thing that links them, which is both had illicit affairs, or at the very least, illicit feelings for people they shouldn't have. Charlotte herself was in love with a married man. And while that affair almost definitely didn't go as far as the Branwell Lydia one, it shows that she really shouldn't be the first to throw the first stone.
That's funny, because Branwell's life in this book kind of mirrors a little bit his life in reality as well. And I'll jump around because, I think about these things as you say them. The one interaction between Charlotte and Lydia, which I'm certainly not going to spoil, really does seem pivotal in a certain sense with regard to Lydia's fascination with her, what she might expect in return and what she gets in return.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's often true with women that There are women that we might not even know very well, but who we feel a sense of competition with, or kind of irk us in the back of our mind, maybe because they made different choices, maybe because we see something similar in them as is in us. And so I really wanted this looming presence. Another part of that is just how important Charlotte was to Branwell overall. The siblings were all incredibly close, but particularly after the death of the oldest two, Mariah and Elizabeth, we really do see the others operating in pairs with Charlotte and Branwell, and then Emily and Anne. It's in those pairs that they build out a lot of their juvenilia, the worlds of Angria and Gondel. And so Charlotte really is pivotal to Branwell's imaginative development. And I have him as quite obsessed with the idea that Charlotte might finish a novel before him or be the greater writer amongst the pair of them.
Well, that goes back to the epitaph, which we kind of slopped over. Your epitaph, which you must have given a lot of thought to, is simply for the women who didn't write their novels. And we go back to that time and it was like, okay, you could get married well, or you could become a tutor or a governess. You didn't really have a lot of choices. So I guess you dedicate this book to those who, like Emily Dickinson, who had the potential and in this case, all wrote under the name pseudonyms of men. So who are you dedicating it to?
Yeah, I did put a lot of thought into that dedication. I think it comes from two places. One, my frustration in historical fiction that a lot of the time our heroines do seem to be the exception. They always believe that women should have the right to vote. They're always advocating that they should be able to lead a different life and a better life. But then I see the reality, which is that most of us just accept the circumstances that society gives us, and we try and make the best and get on as we can and play by the rules. Not many people are revolutionaries and out there changing the world. Most of us are just trying to get by. And there's a heavy streak of pragmatism in Lydia Robinson, the way that I've depicted her. She's not a stupid woman. She might not be as educated or as learned as the Bronte sisters, but she's learned that the way to get ahead is to act a certain way, especially in her interactions with men. And she's learned that from her own mother, her sister, and all the female role models she's been surrounded with. There's a few interactions between her and Anne where you really see that difference very clearly. She tells Anne that you have to choose between being a drudge or a burden. Drudge meaning you have to work for your own living, something that Lydia doesn't see as empowering. She sees it as a failure that you haven't found a man to look after you. And a burden, who wants to be that? The poor relation living on the charity of others. Of course, I think Lydia's tragedy and the tragedy of so many women is that she doesn't imagine a third way, which is the way the Bronte sisters found, which is, oh, well, you could be the most exceptional novelist of your age. But that feels like a very lofty ambition and doesn't even come onto Lydia's radar until she hears about the Bronte sisters and their writing. So yes, I wanted to dedicate this book to all of the women then who didn't think that their voices were worth hearing, that didn't see any other options for them apart from playing this game or being a drudge or a burden. But I also think there's some of it which is still dedicated to women now. There are so many women who I think would express themselves, who do have stories to tell. But putting others first is part of what women do. I think we still have a lot to learn from this idea of having a room of one's own, the space to create. And a lot of women, especially older women and mothers, don't necessarily have that. And again, this is why I wanted to tell a story of a woman in her 40s. There are too many historical novels with teenage or 21-year-old protagonists, and I would love to see that shift.
Every answer you give me gives rise to a question that's not in line on my notes. And this was when you said Angria. And there actually was a found manuscript that actually does kind of deal with Angria. Angria is as close in this book as you can get to magical realism. So why don't you tell us a little bit what Angria is and who its characters are? It's fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. So like a lot of creative people, the Brontes grew up really engaging in imaginative play. And a really key moment in the development of that was when they were given this set of toy soldiers, or more accurately, Branwell was given the set of toy soldiers, but all of them started to play with them. This is mentioned in a very pivotal scene in my novel, one of the first one-on-one interactions that happens between Lydia and Branwell, where he tells her this story. each of them christened their soldiers, and it's very revealing that while Charlotte chose to make hers Wellington, Branwell really made his Bonaparte. So they're setting themselves up in opposition, with him playing out the archetypal kind of bogeyman of the 19th century. So from these first kind of stories and play acting with these soldiers, they started developing what became two separate worlds of Angria and Gondel, peopled with many characters. And the most important in terms of the background for my novel was Northangerland, who's the Duke character, a rake going around seducing women. He really feels like Branwell's alter ego, or the person that Branwell longs to be. And he uses that sign off, Northangerland, in his published poems. So it's the poems I include in the novel are old Branwell's. Early readers would ask me tentatively, did you write these? And I would say, oh, thank goodness, no, I didn't. They're Branwell's. They're not good, are they? And I don't think they're very good. But he used this sign off rather than his own name when they were published in local newspapers. In the novel, I have him signing off some letters to Lydia with that name as well. So we really see him see this affair and see this relationship as maybe an extended part of his play acting. And I think you're right to, in the introduction, say, is this love? Is it something like it? Because I see it as two people who are projecting a lot onto each other, and really falling in love with idealized versions of what they want the other to be. And I think that's especially true in Branwell and how he casts Lydia as this woman to be rescued from a brutish husband, which isn't an accurate portrayal of what's going on in this unhappy house.
It's so funny that you're Miss Austin in our bookstore is Wellington.
Yes, there's a lot of funny things going on with names here, though I am Austin with an I.
Right.
And when I'm British, so growing up, I always had to specify that. And since moving to the US, I would say to people, Austin with an I, and the response would be, well, of course, I know how to spell Austin, Texas. So now I don't reference Jane so frequently.
That's really funny. So let's talk about Branwell's looks. And it's funny because I enjoyed reading about it. You know, Francis Leyland says his features were handsome. And then this other guy says he was almost insignificantly small with ferrety eyes. And then you have the self-portrait where he's not very handsome. And then you have the other portrait where he just paints himself out. So I wonder what he looked like.
I know. And that's an interesting line to walk. One thing I do have in my novel is that he's not particularly tall. I have him being around the same height as Lydia. I think it was around 5'6". So I suggest they're pretty equal in height. She definitely finds him attractive, but he's 25. And 25-year-olds tend to look better than men in their 40s, like her husband. So I certainly have moments where he appears like that Byronic hero, especially when he's writing poetry in an early morning or leaning out the window of where he lives and smoking. Like, there's definitely an aura of mystique around him that Lydia finds attractive. But is he conventionally a beautiful man? I don't think so. I will also say that just having studied the 19th century extensively, I was often surprised by the portraits that I saw of people. You would read descriptions of how beautiful somebody was, and then when you see the picture, my first thought was often, really? So I do think there maybe is some difference in what was seen as attractive then versus now. And, you know, we're talking about a time with no hair dye, no makeup. Lydia's very self-conscious in the novel, for instance, about turning gray. And nowadays, she could just go to the salon. But for a 43-year-old woman then, it's kind of irreversible. And there's no way out and no way to escape this aging process.
She still looked pretty good. And her hair looks pretty good, too. I like the way in the sex scenes, you have this intimation that he has these rippling muscles in his back. Because that gives him some. What about the sex scenes? I wouldn't say they're explicit, but they're really good. And that you wouldn't expect that. And also the manner in which Lydia kind of, she said, no, this isn't exactly what I was expecting. I can figure out how to take care of this.
Yeah, thank you. Well, one, I thought it would be ridiculous to have a novel centered on an affair that didn't go into at least some detail about the sex scene. So while they're not graphic in terms of terminology, I thought it was very important that I didn't just fade to black. If you're going to risk every part of your life for a sexual affair, we're going to need to know about the sex, as far as I'm concerned. But on the other hand, I wanted to be practical about this. I didn't want to just not mention birth control, for instance, which is something that comes up in the plot, because too often that's glossed over. I definitely didn't want their first time to be good. I don't think that's a lot of women's experiences with a new partner. And I'd say the first time is not that satisfying for Lydia, and she kind of needs to teach him what to do. And then I thought, what an interesting moment. So many women spent their whole lives just sleeping with one man, their husband. They were expected to be virgins when they got married. And what a new experience to have sex with somebody new. So even though Lydia is in her 40s at this point, her experience is extremely limited. And that was just an interesting moment for me to try and inhabit her head and think, well, what would this be like for her? And if she was the one in charge, what would their sex life look like?
And, you know, now that I think about it, the only, well, Georgiana, but the only true adult love in the book really is the past with Lydia and her husband when they first were married. And that seemed almost, the way it was portrayed, to Lydia, it seemed almost idyllic. Like,
yeah,
that was what she thought. And she still wanted that.
Yes, I definitely have her as a woman who feels shunned by her husband. And I think that Edmund is a little bit unknowable for us in the novel because the book is from Lydia's perspective. We can never know exactly what's going on with him. We know his health is failing, so it's possible that he's suffering from impotence and has no language for expressing that and is embarrassed. Because of course, while there's a lot of expectations on women, there are a hell of a lot of expectations on men in the period as well. And I think we could see Edmund as a victim of that. On the other hand, perhaps his reluctance to sleep with his wife stems from the loss of their youngest child. We know that many relationships do not survive the death of a young child, and we definitely see that strain. He's concerned that Lydia shouldn't have another child because she's too old. Maybe he doesn't want to go through that loss again. But I definitely didn't want this to be a stereotypically awful Victorian marriage that had been bad from the start. And for Lydia, this is the summation of everything she was meant to achieve in her life. Her wedding day is the proudest moment. She talks about entering this home as a victor. For her, she's achieved the laurel. And then, of course, once she produces the heir, she's achieved everything that she was meant to in life and doesn't know what to do next. The other place I would say that we maybe see love, though it's not as explored in the novel, is in Lydia's relationship with her lady's maid, Anne Marshall. At the beginning of the novel, we see Lydia as someone who's barely being touched. Her husband is shunning her sexually. Her children are giving her less and less physical affection as they become teenagers, and with all that entails, kind of shun their mother. And it's her lady's maid who she has this level of physical intimacy with. Anne Marshall dresses her, she undresses her, she bathes her in the course of the novel, she brushes her hair, she's the one entering her chamber pots, and later she's the one who has some idea of what's going on between Lydia and Branwell. And I think that kind of deep level of intimacy with a servant is something that's very difficult for us to imagine today. And it was important for me that you could read that relationship as potentially having sexual undertones or overtones. And later in the novel, you have a moment where Lydia questions that. She says, was there really nothing but between a maidservant and a mistress between us? So there is an intimation that she's getting something out of that intimacy with this woman who's very much at a power disadvantage. And again, we can't know how she feels about what's going on.
Yeah, we really can't. Well, that goes back to my introduction about, or the end of my introduction about, do we have a reliable narrator or not? And for good or for bad, we're not able to get any perspective because we're always inside of it. And
yes,
not to be like, yeah. I was going to say, not to be, to use the word, but Lydia's a real bitch.
Right. She can be. I mean, so I think there's a couple of things in that. One, we have access to Lydia's thoughts. And I think a lot of us, male and female, can be a bitch inside our own heads.
That's what I was gonna say.
So there is a level of self-editing. Sometimes she can be openly cruel to people, but a lot of times that cruelty is limited to the inside. For instance, she's at the theater and Anne Bronte faints, and one of her first thoughts is, oh no, I'll need to get another governess, which might not seem a very empathetic reaction to us, but perhaps there are people listening who've had their nanny call in sick for the day, their babysitter cancel, and had the same thought first, not, I hope they're okay, but oh my goodness, I've got to sort out my childcare. So I do think there's a level of judgment here if we're just judging her on the inside. But it is true that she has moments where she is less than charming to those people around her. And I think that's because if someone is being so trapped, has so few options, they can't get a divorce, they have no property rights, they're essentially infantilized their entire lives. Would you be very nice? And I think it's a lot to expect of our female characters, to have them be perfectly 21st century in their morals, very woke about their privilege, and at the same time, unflappably nice to everybody around them. And on the privilege point, it was important for me that I showed Lydia's blind spots there in particular. She only expresses her delight at the end of slavery and manumission in order to appear good at a dinner party. She compares herself to a slave going to the galleys when she's just going to an awkward luncheon. And she brags about her Indian shawls without thinking about the colonial economics that make her having these luxury goods possible. So while she's very bound up in her own problems, she certainly has a blind spot with thinking about other people's, whether that's her servants or a wider network of people who are being abused by the empire.
Parenthetically, up in the right-hand corner of my screen, I keep seeing all these people going to Eventbrite and signing up for the thing in August.
Just that's amazing.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, and also there are certain things that have to happen, but you do them so gracefully, like when she, three times, when she kind of sees Anne's letter, and then when she sees another letter kind of just floating about, and also when she eavesdrops at the door of the party, recognizing that she's looked at in a different way than she probably presumed she would be.
Yeah, and that scene was a very pivotal one for me. I do think that you have a problem with bright female characters in historical novels is that they often aren't on stage for the action. So I didn't want to have too much eavesdropping. The letters are partly there as a device to get other people's perspectives in so that you understand what's going on. But this scene where she's the only woman at a dinner party and then is away from the table, for me, that's where my heart breaks for her and for other women like her. She feels disadvantaged. She can't talk about politics. She doesn't know anything about reform. She's just being taught how to be showy and superficial, and she's starting to feel those limitations. And there's a real humiliation in that scene where they're ostensibly praising her, especially her attractiveness. But really, it's with an incredibly patronizing edge that I think a lot of women will be able to relate to.
Yeah, and with her soon-to-be scandalous marriage, the way she does things is like the way she pushes her leg against his during the conversation and puts her hand on him, and he responds. This is her tool. This has been her mechanism, and it's failed a lot of times. But she didn't expect the response. So early in the relationship, she's like, oh no, this is gonna happen again, you know? I thought, and yeah. So your answer kind of softened me towards her, and that softened me as well.
Yes, I definitely didn't want to write a perfect victim. I think there's a lot that we can critique her for, but I hope people come away understanding why she makes the decisions that she does. And there's a few references to that kind of thing about catching on to a drowning man, this idea that if I had to tie myself to a man and I had to, like, it may as well be to the prow of the tallest ship. So she's just a woman who has to be carried by the tides of other people, and she doesn't see a path where she can be independent. After the death of her first husband, her choices are to become that poor relation, living on others' charity, being patronized by her sister, or to wed herself to a man. And that could end up as badly as it did the first time.
But in your acknowledgments, you talk about Ms. Gaskell and her biography, but she says Lydia was profligate and the destroyer of families.
Yes, well, Mrs. Gaskell, who I love as well as a novelist in her own right, but she was a great friend of Charlotte's, and she really does write that biography to kind of perpetrate Charlotte Bronte's version of history. Charlotte has only recently died when this biography is written, and Lydia actually threatens to sue Mrs. Gaskell for libel for what she says about her in the book. She's not named, but everyone knows which family is being referred to. By that point, she's a titled lady, pretty powerful. Her lawyers write, and Mrs. Gaskell's publisher actually withdraws the allegations. So in later editions, you won't see this affair mentioned at all.
That's interesting, especially since she wasn't named. Hey, yes. So that's totally off topic. What's the deal with Cowan Bridge School? Why would you send your kid there? It sounds horrible.
I know. So I only have one reference to this. Well, I guess two references to this awful school in the novel. One, its role in the deaths of the oldest two Bronte siblings, Mariah and Elizabeth, who were both sent home from that school to die. And two, I have the anecdote with Charlotte standing on a chair as a punishment at that school, which is taken from a scene in Jane Eyre. Whether that actually happened to Charlotte, we don't know. It's possible that was something that happened to one of her older sisters that she wrote about from a different perspective later. But it's such a powerful moment that I wanted to mention that. And it really sets up Charlotte as the heroine who Lydia is not in Lydia's mindset. My personal feeling about why they were sent there or why they weren't removed sooner goes back a lot to Reverend Bronte, I think, loved his children, but he was also a man reeling from the death of the love of his life, who had borne him 6 children in quick succession and then succumbed to ovarian cancer and a very painful death. And I recently read a wonderful biography by Sharon Wright called Mother of the Brontes about Mariah Branwell, who became Mariah Bronte the Elder, who is the mother of the household. Most of the Bronte siblings who survived didn't have very strong memories of her, but this book does a wonderful job in talking about the impact of that tragedy on the wider family. And I think in some ways you could say that Reverend Bronte never really recovered and certainly made some errors of judgment in those early years of child rearing, potentially because he was a distraught widower.
It's funny, it's almost like the Kennedy dynasty. When I think of Mariah, she was so advanced and such a good reader and writer. You think, what if she had lived? Because all these kids at such a young age showed such genius.
I think that's a question, right? I mean, maybe it would have helped, or maybe if they were happier, it would have given them less time alone to come up with their make-believe worlds. We can never really know. Somebody asked me that question about, like, if you could stop Branwell going to Fort Greene Hall, would you? And no, I wouldn't. I want to see it play out in real time if I had the choice. But I think that this is a family that underwent multiple tragedies, and those tragedies certainly inform the tone and content of some of the novels that we've come to love.
Why are they all called halls? All the homes are called halls. Why?
I don't know why there were so many halls. I guess Kirby Hall, Great Bar Hall, Alstrey Hall. Yeah, I do have a lot of halls in the novel, it's true. I guess that was probably the size of house with people of this class. Like, they're not, I don't know, they're not quite palaces, are they? But they're grand enough to be halls and definitely better than houses. Yeah. I wish I'd had time to go to Great Bar Hall and to Alstrey Hall. Both still stand. But I end up doing a lot of research watching YouTube videos of people trespassing, which apparently is a subgenre of YouTube video. So thank you to those brave souls trespassing and breaking and entering because they gave me some great details.
Her second husband, it's more than a hall. It's almost a mansion. So that's what made me start thinking about it, you know?
Yeah, it's beautiful. Only the shell survives. It was actually mentioned in Parliament pretty recently because there's a legal battle going on. It sits on the Green Belt and there are developers who want to resurrect it, but they also want to put up some housing for folks in the Green Belt area. So it was interesting to stumble across that clip of the House of Commons debating Great Bar Hall.
It's funny, we're talking about that and talking about the three sisters. Lydia uncovers this and is not sure. She's reading it. This is where it gets to be a little bit like magical realism. It's like when she's reading a book by Kerr or Acton and Ellis. So explain to people who might not know who they were and why their initials are the way they are.
Yes. So a lot of people know Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre and Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights, and they may know that Anne also wrote two books, Agnes Grey and The Tenant of Wildfell Hall. But the story of the book's publication is really an interesting one. So the Bronte sisters wanted to be anonymous, and they wrote under names that really suggested they were men, though I think they have an element of seeming a little bit gender neutral, which I think is interesting today. So Currer Bell was Charlotte Bronte, Ellis Bell, that's Emily, and then Acton, Anne. And in the same year, we see Charlotte is writing her first written book, which becomes her last published book, The Professor, at the same time as Emily is writing Wuthering Heights and Anne is writing Agnes Grey, a novel which is in part based on her experiences at Fort Greene Hall. How closely, we might debate, and lots of academics have done so. When they send these off for publication, they write as the Bell brothers, and initially only Wuthering Heights and Agnes Grey get accepted by a publisher, and Charlotte is left disappointed. And Charlotte very quickly writes another novel, which becomes Jane Eyre, still the most successful Bronte novel that we've had. She finds a different publisher. When Jane Eyre comes out, it's a sensation, with Wuthering Heights and Agnes Grey, which are published in the same volume, not doing so well. But there's almost immediately a lot of interest in who are these Bell brothers? Are there really three of them? Are there enough similarities or differences between the writing style? Some people posit that they're actually a husband and wife team. Their genders are debated in newspapers. And ultimately, when some of the publishers start very badly suggesting that all of the books are by Currer Bell because of the success of Jane Eyre, Anne and Charlotte actually have to go to London and prove their identities to their very shocked publisher, who has these two tiny little Yorkshire women turn up on his doorstep and announce that they're two of the three Bells. Emily wants nothing to do with it. So I don't think it's magical realism at all. It's very likely that Lydia Robinson would have read these books, but at the moment that she does read Jane Eyre, it's not public knowledge who the Bells are. But of course, she recognizes the initials, and she recognizes some of the source material for Agnes Grey, including a very unflattering depiction of her in the character of Mrs. Murray.
Yeah, that's what I meant, that she's reading about herself without knowing that she's reading about herself while she's writing about herself.
Yes, I guess there's a lot going on in that.
So we haven't talked about Lydia the Senior's children. So if you could get a thumbnail, they're very different and very interesting. And if you could give a thumbnail sketch of each of them, starting with one who's no longer with us, who is the other example of true love.
Yes. So Lydia, as I mentioned, is a mother of five. When the novel starts, she's a mother of four because her youngest and most beloved daughter, Georgiana, has died just under 2 years before. So Georgiana died as a toddler of whooping cough while Anne Bronte was in the house. And I have that loss as especially devastating to Lydia. And she's just suffered the loss of her own mother as well in the weeks before the novel starts. So she's really grieving double, both for her favorite child and then for her mother. The way I paint Georgiana as her favorite for a couple of reasons. One, because she was the child born just to be loved. Initially, Lydia was really trying to have a son, and she has three daughters with Edmund before she produces the heir, also Edmund, known as Ned, who becomes Branwell's pupil. So with each of the three girls, she details how they were a disappointment because she was looking for that son. And then with the son, he was just a relief that she'd done her job. But with Georgiana, she could really enjoy being a mother. I have her make choices, for instance, breastfeeding Georgiana, where she sends the others out to a wet nurse, which is pretty common in the period. So she has that intimacy with Georgiana. And the other context here is that in her early pregnancies, her awful mother-in-law was living with the family, whereas later I have her able to really enjoy motherhood and those infant years of Georgiana in a way that she hasn't with her oldest girls. The other thing I have about Georgiana, which makes her so beloved for Lydia, is that she is the most imaginative child and the most creative. Lydia has her own moments of creativity. She's a great musician. She's a great singer. She loves playing the piano. but no one's ever taken her aspirations seriously until Branwell says that she's an artist and a poet, something that she really responds to. And there's a moment where she talks about how Georgiana was a very imaginative child, how she had imaginary tea parties and invited her mother in to this play, which of course is reminiscent of the sort of play that the Brontes enjoyed. With her four surviving children, though, they're very different. And four children, three girls and a boy, just like the Brontes, but a very different upbringing. And we definitely don't see that same type of imaginative playfulness and communion that we see in the Bronte household. So we have Lydia, the oldest, who might remind people of the oldest daughter of the Murray family in Agnes Grey, a beauty, a flirt, obsessed with getting married. And I don't want to give too many spoilers here, but she made some pretty dramatic choices of her own, which might be reminiscent of another Lydia, Lydia Bennet in Pride and Prejudice, which was really a parallel that I wanted to draw. Then we have Bessie, Elizabeth, known as Bessie. I have her as being obsessed with horses, scraping her knees, eating with a very healthy appetite. And that's in part based on the second Murray daughter in Agnes Grey as well. And of course, knowing that her father and little brother were horse obsessed, it made sense to have a girl who was as well. And so with her relationship with Lydia, Lydia is extremely concerned that Bessie is not ladylike enough, that she eats too much, that she's not watching her weight. And I think this is one of those moments where you might characterize it as bitchy, but Lydia sees this as tough love, right? She's got to stop her daughter eating too much butter on her bread because otherwise she's not going to get that husband. And I know plenty of women today who've passed on their own body issues to their daughters. So I don't think this is too alien an idea. And then we have Mary, who's the quietest and most affectionate daughter, very much a middle child, often overlooked, initially excluded by her two oldest sisters until the family dynamic changes, really desperate for her mother's affection. But Lydia has really removed it and taken it elsewhere, potentially as a defense mechanism with the birth of her youngest child. And then Ned, the boy, he's 10 at the start of the novel. He's Branwell's pupil. He's very much the child of the house while the girls are more in that teenage mode and seeing themselves as grown. But for Lydia, she feels like she's losing him. He's going to start learning all the things that she wasn't allowed. What does she know about Latin and Cambridge? She expresses at one point. She would prefer to keep him a child forever. And she feels an increased distance from him because he's a boy and she's a woman as the novel moves on. So it was very important for me that every minor character in the novel believe themselves to be the protagonist, as it were. And I certainly think with the three oldest girls, they all think that, especially the younger Lydia. She believes she's the star of the show. And you could write this novel a very different way, where it's her story and she's much more of the conventional historical fiction heroine.
That's what's so good about all the characters, whether they take a page or more, they're so well developed. I think I'm getting the name right of the doc. Is it Dr. Crosby?
Crosby, yeah. That's right.
Yeah, he could have his own novel too, especially given his unusual disclosure. And that was kind of, it was amazing how vulnerable he made himself at that one point. And also that disclosed his goodness too, because he was one of the truly good people in the book.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, so Dr. Crosby, what's known about him is that he does seem to have been, as well as the family doctor for the Robinsons, a close friend of Branwell's. They were both Freemasons, and there is some evidence that he acted as this go-between once Branwell is dismissed from the house, ferrying letters and potentially money from Lydia to Branwell back at Haworth. So his reputation in Bronte scholarship has not been great. People have said, why is he aiding and abetting this affair? Some people have suggested that he was another victim of this femme fatale Lydia. Perhaps he was in love with her too. And my choice to sketch him the way I did was twofold. One, I wanted absolutely no suggestion of a sexual or romantic relationship between Lydia and the doctor. So his secret kind of precludes that. And two, he was obviously beloved locally. So if you go to the area, everybody in Great Usman, this village, knows who Dr. John Crosby was, even nearly 200 years on, because he has the biggest memorial in the local church, St. Mary's. There's an obelisk to him in the churchyard. He died pretty young in his 50s. He collapsed in King's Cross Station, and people were obviously devastated by his death. He'd been widowed very young. He chose never to marry again, also suggestive to me of his predilections. But local people absolutely adored him and, you know, took up money after his death to have this beautiful memorial. So I wanted to depict him as a good person. I also wanted to show that, you know, people have other stuff going on, and that it's not only Lydia and women who are confined by the society that they're living in. So I hope I did him justice. I actually got to take tea in his front parlor during my research trip, because the house still exists, and I hope the current owners aren't too shocked about the scene that transpires there.
Yeah. It's funny that, well, first of all, she didn't really have to go to him in the first place. Who knew? And that still happens today as well. But she wasn't discreet about anything, and she was in such dire straits that, and then she gets really screwed because of Mrs. Sewell and the other people who know exactly what's going on. It's not like she didn't care, but by going to Monk Hall and just like in her shift, you know, that was hard to, well, first it was hard to understand, but then I realized I could do the same thing. Everyone has a tipping point.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that unites Lydia and Branwell is they're both pretty reckless. And there's this passage, right, where Lydia talks about how men have so many vices open to them. She says they can choose when to drink, they can gamble on horses, they can leap over hedges, they can visit prostitutes. And what does she have? She doesn't even get to choose when she drinks, because she gets sent out of the dining room when they move on to the hard liquor. She hasn't ridden a horse in years. She can't gamble. She had to stay a virgin till marriage, unlike her husband, who confides in her about his youthful liaisons in Cambridge. And so Branwell really becomes her drug of choice. And with that addictive behavior comes desperation. There comes this moment where people, you know, how many of us have kept sleeping with someone we knew we shouldn't? People are often really drawn to those who are no good for them. And I definitely think that's what's going on. Lydia uses Branwell as a vice, as a way out, as a way to feel something. In the first chapter, she just says she wants anybody to touch her just so she feels she's still alive, because all she can look forward to is dying like her daughter and her mother, which is just a really sad predicament. And I don't believe that she should have to resign herself to a life without pleasure, a life without touch, just because her husband has made the decision that at 43, she's too old for all that.
Yeah, I know. And you set it up well, because, you know, she tries so hard that one night with Edmund, so to speak. She tries so hard to make things work. And this is the inroad that she believes she has. And then she's rebuffed. And I think that might have been the time when she's gone, you know what? Screw him, so to speak.
Yeah. And I mean, a lot of the time a married couple slept separately, and Lydia makes several references to that. She says her whole life has been waiting. She had to wait for a man to ask her to marry him. She is to wait there in the dark and hope that he visits her at night. So some of her gadding around in her shift, right, may be totally reckless, but it's the first time in her life she says, this is what I want. And you know what? I want to be touched. I want to experience pleasure, and I'm not going to wait anymore. And even in her second marriage, while she still has to play the game, she is the master manipulator, getting what she wants. She doesn't want to wait to marry again. And she really is taking her life into her own hands, even if it's in a way that we can't see as quite heroic.
When you were writing this and researching it, coming down to the end of this, when you were writing and researching it, can you tell us what you really think happened?
Yeah, so in the author's note at the end of the novel, I do lay out the evidence for and against the affair. And I think on balance that something happened, right? It seems very clear that Branwell, Lydia, or more probably both of them were lying. There is a very early reference to him saying his mistress is damnably too fond of him in a letter, which could just be bragging. He says he has a lock of her hair. But something causes Anne to resign, something causes him to be dismissed, and he definitely went off the deep end when he was dismissed in terms of his drinking and opium taking and all of his bad habits. Lydia does seem to have sent the coachman, William Allison, to Haworth with news of Edmund's death. There does seem to have been correspondence via Dr. Crosby, so clearly something went on. Of course, as the novelist, you have to choose moments of more dramatic potential. And I think there's a couple of those I would call out. Having Branwell get on the train to go travel from York to Scarborough. It's possible because there was this big train opening at that time, but it is just a very dramatic moment and allows me to have them in the same place when the record shows they were probably apart. So I'd say that's possible, but not probable. The meeting with Charlotte as well is there really for the dramatic story arc. That's not something that we have any evidence happened. But again, not totally outside the realm of reality. So I think a lot of this is likely the way it went down in terms of what an older married woman might see in someone like Branwell. I feel like the emotional heart of the novel is potentially true, but the details of what people said on which day and what they thought and felt are obviously always going to be hidden from us. I do know which day every scene is meant to have taken place, though, because a lot of the incidents were based on evidence. And in my first drafts of the novel, I didn't have conventional chapters. I did have the date stamp on every scene. That was something that I took out while working with my agent, put it into more conventional chapters. But if there are any real Bronte kind of obsessives out there who want to talk the details of why each scene happened on the day it did or which day of the week anything is, I can check that. I did have to make sure that important things didn't happen on Sundays because they would be at church and I didn't want to have too many church scenes. I did check calendars, for instance. I took out moonlight from one scene when I realized there was a new moon that night. So I held myself to a very high standard on some details that nobody but me was ever going to know.
Well, you know, this has been a great taste of what's to come when we have our get together on August 13th. And I probably will introduce the two of you, but there is a woman who comes to our bookstore. She used to be the manager, actually, Leslie, and she'll probably moderate it because she's obsessed with both the Brontes and with Jane Austen. And I think it'll be fascinating for her. And I think she'll help move things along, but it'll be interesting. I didn't mean to say it's going to be a knockdown drag out, but it'll be fun, I think, because there are so many contrasts between.
Oh, I think it's going to be really fun. And, you know, my little sister, you referenced her earlier, my poor, long-suffering sister, I had to hear all my early stories. When I told her about this event, she said, what are you going to do, a rap battle? And I don't think my rapping skills are quite there, but I'm happy to set it up with the Austen versus Brontes, especially because Charlotte didn't have the nicest things to say about Jane Austen. Right. I'm sure we'll do that.
Yeah, I almost wanted to say that. I can't do it in his voice, that let's get ready to rumble guy.
Yeah. Yes.
So anyway, I've been talking with Fionnuala Austen regarding her book, Bronte's Mistress. And again, just to keep you guys in the loop, August 13th, well, the book's going to be published August 4th, and then the 13th, and I wish it was at the bookstore. We are open 4 days a week now, so your book will be out there to purchase at the front table. And yeah, so we'll hear about the Jane Austen Society versus your book. And there'll be, obviously with Zoom, everyone will have the opportunity to put their comments and questions down the side. Both of you will see it at the same time. And I will be the anonymous interloper asking questions that are, why would anybody ask that question? That'll be me.
Well, I'm very excited for that. And I just hope enough Team Bronte people turn out. You know, I worry that Jane Austen has this one in terms of number of super fans, but I know the Bronte lovers are out there.
Oh, I know what I'll do. You know how you go to Starbucks sometime and they have those two tip jars, like dogs and cats? I'll do one Bronte and one Austen. That way we can keep you posted as to whether you're the underdog. Yeah, it'll be like Vegas odds. We can do that.
Yeah, no, I do feel like the underdog in this fight, but then I get three novelists for the price of one, so that's got to be some advantage.
Good point. I thought of that too. Well, thank you so much. This was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed talking to you. I look forward to seeing you like this on August 13th at our store, Wellington Square Bookshop.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
Thanks.